I'm happy to be with you this afternoon. I have one regret, however, and that is that it is last March since we had the last clinic. And that it hasn't been possible to have other clinics such as this, and even much bigger than this, since that time. We had planned one for October in Toronto, but it had to be abandoned because of circumstances. And it does seem as if the closer you get to really touching the pulse of the devil's 20th century representation of himself and misrepresentation of Christ and all that Christianity has brought to the generations of the past, the closer you get, I say, to touching the devil's pulse, the more resistance you'll find and the more obstacles are placed in your way. That is true, of course, of Dr. Fred Schwarz's work, and he's discovered it more and more, and we need to pray one for another that we may be kept true and faithful. It is not an easy thing to be fighting this thing called communism and to keep absolutely true to God and to his word and to the message which alone can counteract this monstrous thing. Now, my talk to you this afternoon is going to be entirely different from that type of talk that you've heard from Dr. Schwarz and also from Dr. Jupp. Theirs have been factual in the sense of collation of historical facts culled from a political and experience in one case and an experience in another case of traveling around the world and delving into the theories of communism. Dr. Fred Schwarz is able to give us an astonishing background. Perhaps there isn't a second man in the world at the present time who can expose it and its theories in so adequate and so effective a manner. My method of approach is entirely different. You see, so many of us, whilst we become interested in communism, some because of fear of communism itself, and because we want to try to put it off and to do something about it, others become interested because they realize that they are responsible for others who follow them, especially for our children. Recently, in a group of men, I asked them if they would be frank enough to tell me, why are you interested in fighting communism? And out of 40 men, 32 acknowledged by raising of their hands that the reason that they had become interested in fighting it because they were afraid of the world they were going to leave to their children. This was the fear they had. Now, there is some reason behind it. Why are we trying to face the challenge of communism? Well, I'm not going to answer the question, but I'm going to try and put into my talk this afternoon something that will make you answer the question yourself. The principal of a Woodstock, New Brunswick high school rose after I had addressed the students, and he said, as we were being challenged by this speaker this afternoon, I couldn't help thinking of the multitude of times when I have said, it couldn't happen here. I no longer believe that now, and I will do all I can, as a good Canadian, he was speaking, of course, to stop it from happening in this country. I'm going to take you behind the Iron Curtain. I'm not going to speak out of a book or a theory. You're going to live with me under communism. If I don't attain this objective this afternoon, I have lost the opportunity of this hour. Before communism came into China, I was amongst those missionaries, such as Dr. Jupp spoke of this morning, who were taken up with a great many interesting things, and amongst them, those people who came along and talked about peace and the need to have a China that was at peace in a world that was at peace. I attended some of their meetings in various cities of China. And then, as an evangelical missionary, I realized that I couldn't have a part in many of the things that they were doing. And only for this reason did I withdraw myself. I couldn't really, however, disagree with much of their attitude from a political point of view. I couldn't, for instance, say at that time that I knew sufficient about communism to condemn it. Why condemn a thing about which you know very little? Surely, as a missionary and a Christian leader, it was my duty to give the benefit of the doubt. And this I tried to do. I tried to give the communists the benefit of the doubt. I tried to realize that, after all, they were doing the best they could. And then when I took a look at the Chinese nationalist government, I had to acknowledge that they were full of corruption. I had to acknowledge that the funds of UNRWA and the International Famine Relief Commission were being mishandled. Living on the inside in China, I was appalled by the traffic of the black markets of that country and could do nothing else but speak against all the corruption amongst officials as well as amongst the people. As a missionary, wasn't it my task that I should bring a message that promised men deliverance from sin? Therefore, it's only logical that where I saw sin, I went after it. And the corruption amongst the officials was one of the targets that we as missionaries tried to hit with every punch we could give. And so we went after the corruption amongst the nationalist government. In fact, I was close enough to the Chiang Kai-shek administration, that is, geographically, so that I was invited very often to go to speak at the home of General Chiang Kai-shek at Feng Hua, not far from Shanghai. And I knew a considerable number of the officials. And I knew some of them who were doing things that we and the whole community knew about that should be exposed. We spoke about them to them in private, as well as having to expose things in public. And yet, it went on until it came to the place where the regime was so corrupt, and I'm speaking of the Chiang Kai-shek regime, was so corrupt that eventually the general populace were at the place where they were saying, well, why not give communism a chance? Communism couldn't be any worse than this, so why not give communism a chance? And that was what China did. It gave communism a chance. Dr. Schwarz has pointed out to you that it is not the ignoramuses that embrace communism first. It is the intellectuals. This was the case in China. And the producing of that attitude of mind of give communism a chance was one of the most powerful jobs that the intellectuals of China were able to do. They got in amongst the students. The students were the most ardent. Always, of course, the student wants to lead his generation. And when the Chinese communist students started to go out for their summer holidays, spreading far and wide the communist message that they learned in the universities, a message which was to bring about a new China, to produce that regenerated nation of which Dr. Fred Schwarz spoke to us. It was then that the general populace accepted, and the editorial staffs of the newspapers soon caught on. The communists had their editors in almost every newspaper across the country, just as they wormed their way into the editorial staffs of our newspapers over here. I recommend to you that you watch your newspapers. I recommend to you that in every city, especially now, let me speak of Long Beach and Los Angeles, right here, you should have amongst yourselves men who are constantly spotting leftist articles in the press. They should be brought to the attention of the office of the Anti-Communist Christian Crusade right here, and they should be called upon to do something about it, to write to the newspapers. That's what we're doing up in Canada. You should follow the practice down here. It can't be left just to your senators. I want to tell you that very little that is said on the floor of the House of the Senate ever really gets down to the level of the people, just as in Canada. The press gallery in Canada completely ignores what is said on the floor of the House of Commons. And we know very well it never reaches the people. And I recommend to the people of Canada that they get hold of copies of our Hansard, as it's called up there. Here you have the congressional record. And every one of you should spend the money to get your congressional record sent to you through the mail. Don't trust your press. Your press is telling lies every day. And the biggest lies are the lies in the headlines. Never trust the headline. If you want to know what's in a newspaper article, you look in the last paragraph. And there you're likely to get something of the truth. Because they must put something in. And so towards the end of an article, you'll usually find the real truth about things. The rest of it is just simply blown up, like just a balloon. And so in China, the same thing happened. The press was infiltrated by the leftists. And as Dr. Job told us this morning, the World Council of Christian Churches operating in China was one of the biggest factors for bringing about the communist takeover. Because you've got to remember that the church in China was in a very responsible position. We were working amongst a nation that gave an ear to the church in China. In fact, very often the church's voice in China, of whatever denomination, was more powerful than the local officials. And in consequence, the communists saw their opportunity. And they got into that World Council of Christian Churches. And they got men who didn't know what they were doing, just as Dr. Jung joined that organization. He didn't realize that he was helping forward the communists. As soon as he did, he got out of it. Now, lots of them gone on, and they've never realized it. He spoke about that woman this morning who'd been in 38 communist fronts and then came before the Committee on Un-American Affairs and said that she didn't know the organizations in which she was. I want to tell you that's perfectly genuine. There are hundreds and thousands who are in communist organizations, and a great many of them don't even know the organizations in which they are. There are people up in Canada who are propagating communism from their pulpits. Every week they stand up and speak about peace. Members of the Canadian Peace Congress, members of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, think of that. Fellowship of Reconciliation, taking a wonderful word like reconciliation, one of the most glorious words of all the scripture, that God has in Christ reconciled the world unto himself. And they take that wonderful word, reconciliation, that can mean so much to the man or woman who comes humbly to God and seeks that reconciliation through the shed blood of the Lord Jesus Christ, and they take that wonderful word, reconciliation, and they call it a fellowship of reconciliation. A straight communist front working in the churches up in Canada. And another one, they call it the Canadian Peace Congress. Peace, what a word. What a wonderful Christian word. Peace on earth and goodwill toward men. Why, surely any Christian man can go along with that. And that's what's happened with a lot of these modernistically minded men. A lot of these men in the World Council of Christian Churches have just wrapped it up. And they've got a platform of peace. And they make use of it. And the consequence is the communists have got in so easily amongst them. And they don't know that they're working for the communists. Many of them didn't know it in China. And through the World Council of Christian Churches, they got in China into the Council of Churches in China. And it was an amalgamation of as many of the denominations as they could get to join in their organization, and the communists went after it. And they riddled it through with leaders. And the result was that when these leaders started to talk peace, when these people started to speak about the communists as peace-loving people, when they started to spread the idea that Chinese communists were just simply agrarian reformers, the press took it up, and your American press spread it across the headlines. I still have in my office in Toronto some of your American newspapers with their headlines, "The Agrarian Reformers of China, Mao Zedong and Co." and so on. And so they propagated this idea, and we all listened to it, and we came to the conclusion that perhaps at least they should be given a chance. At least give them a chance to see what they would do. And then, as the Chinese nationalists retreated down through the countryside, after they had ripped up Manchuria, after they came down through from North China and started to retreat, the Chinese nationalist army I'm speaking of, under Chiang Kai-shek, they looted and they pillaged and they plundered in such an abominable fashion that, of course, as the news spread of what they were doing further south, they were not welcome as they came. And we were glad to see the back of them when they went. And I was through the Japanese invasion in China. And I was through that terrible raping of Nanking that you heard about. And I want to tell you that the Japanese were children as compared with the Chinese nationalists when it came to the question of raping a city and tearing it down. And everything that has been said about the Chinese nationalists and the terrible way that they reacted under the pressures of the communists coming from the north, they're true. The difficulty there is this, that the press has never given the other side of the picture. For those of us who stayed behind in China saw the reason why. Why was it that the nationalists acted in this way? It was because the communists had succeeded in infiltrating the nationalist regime at every level to such an extent that even in the army, their agents, they were prepared for any kind of disgrace themselves. It didn't matter what kind of disgrace came upon their name, so long as they could bring a smear upon Chiang Kai-shek. And they certainly succeeded in doing that. And that smear lasts until this very day and is still on him. And your American press is still smearing him. Life magazine and Time and some of these other magazines that more recently even have dug up the old stories about Chiang Kai-shek and republished them, rehashed them. There is a story, if I may interpolate this here, however, that's a true story and up to date. I recommend, since we have no evening meetings, that you might like to listen to your Columbia Broadcasting Corporation, their broadcast over Los Angeles tonight at 8:30. Every night this week, somewhere between 8:30 and 8:45, you will hear, I think his name is Dennis Clark or Harold Clark. He is one of the reporters from the Toronto Star and has just been into China. And he's telling the truth. As we came down, driving down here yesterday evening, we heard one of his talks on the truth of 500 million people. 500 million people. Enslaved. The greatest slave camp in the world today is China. He's telling the truth about it. A courageous man. A really courageous man. They'll be worth listening to and will be supplementary to what we are talking about in these meetings. And so, well, we who stayed behind saw the infiltration having taken its effect, and only then did we realize that many of the men who had been leaders in the Chinese nationalist regime were in fact communist agents well planted who had done a fine job and brought the smear on Chiang Kai-shek until everybody was glad to see the back of the nationalists as they fled down through the country. And they fled, just like frightened rabbits. And we were left for 2 weeks in no man's land. After the communists left our city, or as they left our city, the mayor of the city came around to my house and said to me, "Mr. Millen, why don't you come with us? Come with us and go south with us. The Chinese communists will soon be arriving. They're crossing the river at Nanking. Already all of North China had fallen." And even then we still argued that it couldn't happen where we were living. Even though they'd taken North China, we still didn't believe it, just as there are millions of Americans today. They don't believe that communism will take over America, but they're working for it 24 hours of the day. I hardly need to say that to you, or you wouldn't be here at this anti-communist school. But the fact is that they've worked for it systematically, they've worked for it in China, they've worked for it in every other country that they've taken over, and they're working for it in the United States of America, they're working for it in Canada, they're working for it in Europe. We still didn't believe it, even though it came so close to our door that it was all north of the Yangtze River, which divides China down the center, from east to west, all north of it had gone. And we were waiting just south of the river, wondering what would happen next. And then the Chinese started across the communists started across the river. And as the troops fled, this mayor came and said to me, "Mr. Millen, come with us. Take your school and orphanage and all the workers that you have and your supplies. We'll give you a train if need be, and trucks, and you come down with us and come south. And then when the war is over and we come back, we'll bring you back and reestablish you. If you stay here, these people will kill you off, destroy your work, and it'll be the end of all that you've done." But we had promised our Chinese friends that we were going to stay. After all, the general populace couldn't leave. And then I want to tell you, quite honestly, that the communist propaganda had been so insidious and so clever. The communist propaganda, by means of pamphlets and leaflets and magazines which had come into our home, the radio broadcasts that were put out from northern China and from Mukden, had been so effective that even we were saying, "Well, after all, we really don't know. We really don't know. It may be that we'll still be able to carry on." The communists have said we can. They've said it over the radio. They had sent us letters to tell us not to be afraid. Church work would continue as usual, just the same as they've been taking Americans into Russia and letting them see what they want them to see, and they've been coming back here and telling you that the Baptist Church is free in Russia, and that there is religious freedom behind the Iron Curtain, and a great many churchmen have been lapping it up, especially this group in the World Council of Churches that are now advocating recognition of China. Why, of course, that's just exactly what they want. And so, we were actually saying, well, maybe it won't be so bad. Maybe we can carry on our work after all. So we waited for the communists to come. We waited 2 weeks in no man's land. We ourselves built a small police force to look after the locality. We got a lot of Christian men to cooperate, to keep the populace quiet as we waited. And then it was on a Sunday morning, the second Sunday morning in no man's land. And at daybreak, just as the sun was rising, we heard the rat-tat-tat of machine guns. We all jumped out of bed and rushed to the windows, and looking out there on a little pagoda hill, just outside the east gate of the city, silhouetted against the rising sun, there was a machine gun emplacement beside the pagoda. And the communists were firing off a few rounds of dummy ammunition to announce their arrival, just as in the old days a Chinese general would announce that he was taking over a city by letting off firecrackers to announce his arrival. So they were using a modern means. They were using dummy ammunition. You see, there was hardly any use in using live ammunition, because after all, you can't fire a bullet 2 weeks ahead of yourself, and since the Nationalists had 2 weeks start, there wasn't much use. And then when they knew that every eye would be upon that little hill, it was then that their troops started to file over the top of the hill and down the side of the hill into the east gate of the city, and to march up through the streets of the city, knocking on the doors with their rifle butts, shouting out, "Kai Meng Hua! Kai Meng Hua! Jiu Feng Jing Lai Liao! Open your doors! Open your doors! The People's Liberation Army has arrived!" And I hurriedly pulled on some clothes and rushed down to our big front gate. We had a large campus surrounding all our buildings with a big high wall, and in the center a big gate with a gatehouse built over the top. And I went down and threw open the gates and stood there waiting for the communists to come. And I had a pretty fair reason for doing that, because about a week before, whilst we were still in no man's land, there were messengers who came to bring us the word, spread the message through the city and through the district, tell everybody that when the Liberation Army arrives, we expect every door to be opened. Any door that is kept shut against us will be knocked down, and anybody found behind a closed door will be taken out and shot. And that's a pretty fair incentive to get you to open your front door. So I didn't waste much time getting down to my front door and threw it open and stood there waiting. Behind me in the campus, there were over 200 people, our staff and some refugees, although we had the bulk of the refugees already had left us during the period of waiting for the communists to come. Those who had already been through their hands, they left. They weren't going to stay for any more. And then, as we waited, I received my first shock about communism. For onto my doorstep came a little Chinese lad. I learned the next day he was only 13 years of age. And as he came to the door, I looked at him, dressed in a nice, smart blue silk gown, his hair nicely parted in the middle, which was fashionable in our schools at the time. And the only indication that he was a communist, a strip of red ribbon attached to his collar, and on that red ribbon a slogan, which afterwards we learned was a Chinese slogan, and at the top a five-pointed star, the sign of the communists. And I said, "What can I do for you, laddie? Would you like to come in?" For I didn't know he was a communist then. He said, "I've come to tell you, sir, not to be afraid." "Why," I said, "laddie, what do you think I've got to be afraid of? I'm not ashamed of anything I've been doing. I'm ready to receive the People's Liberation Army when they arrive." "Oh," he said, "I don't mean that, sir. I don't mean that. I've come to tell you that I'm the representative of the People's Liberation Army. And when they see me on your doorstep, and they have told us that if you receive me, they will see, that when they come and see me standing with you, They will not harm you or molest you in any way whatsoever, because I'm their representative. I said, come in, laddie, come in, come in. And in came this little lad and sat beside me and waited for the People's Liberation Army to arrive. And whilst we sat together for several hours, he unfolded for me the amazing story of the infiltration of our schools and how many of the school students were those who had cooperated with the communists. The communists had not asked them to indulge in any acts of sabotage. They had simply asked of them that they would be ready when the day of liberation took place to go to a certain home or factory or workshop or some of the down through some of the silk farms and to stand at the door ready to receive the Chinese Communist Liberation Army when it arrived. You see, it was a wonderful piece of work, for after all, why should we be afraid of little children 13 or 14 years of age? Why, of course, the psychological reaction was absolutely perfect, and we relaxed, and I relaxed talking to this boy. And when the soldiers arrived, why, the shock had gone, and already it had spread back through the campus that the communists had sent their representative on ahead, and he was sitting outside with the foreign missionary, sitting at the door, sipping tea, waiting for the communists to arrive. And the result was everybody had settled down. And as the communist soldiers arrived, as the boy had said, they took hardly any notice of me. They didn't molest me or harm me at all, contrary to all the stories that I'd heard of how they would thrust me through with a bayonet, take off the women and children, burn down the premises, destroy all our work. There was none of this. Instead of which I found that they were coldly polite, but they certainly weren't aggressive. And they asked permission to come in and look around the campus. There was no reason why they shouldn't. They came and took over. And then it was that they got this boy, who was their representative, and showed what they thought of him. They called all the staff and the people we had with us to come and stand outside on the grass outside the school. And then they had this little lad on their shoulders, and they chaired him all around the campus, made a great fuss of him. And when they finished showing that he was their representative, then they got this lad to lead them through the campus. When they had everybody out of the buildings now, and as they went through the campus, this boy, they took from their pockets lists of our property and everything that was there. Not alone the fittings around the buildings, not only the listing of the materials in the school and so on, but even the personal things in our own bedroom were all listed. And they called me upstairs on several occasions. On one occasion they called me up to ask me what had happened to the shirts out of my drawer. They said, there are 3 shirts missing from this drawer. What have you done with them? And I said, well, thank you very much for telling me how many shirts I had. I really didn't know myself. I was so busy with all the refugees we were attending to and all the work of the church, and we were extremely busy up to the time of the Chinese nationalists leaving the city. I said, my wife looks after those things. But if you say there are 3 shirts missing, why, I can quite believe that, because when my shirts get a little threadbare, why, then my wife tears them up and makes dusters out of them for dusting the furniture. Well, I had to take this man downstairs and show him that that was true, because it sounded rather a tall story to a Chinese, for they wear their shirts until there are hardly any threads left at all. The idea of tearing up good broadcloth and making dusters out of it was quite foreign. When they got to my office, they found my typewriter on the desk, which wasn't on their list. And they asked me, what is this? It's not listed here. When I told them it's a Dang Shiji, that is, it is a machine for making letters, they couldn't understand that. They were country bumpkins who'd never seen a typewriter in their lives, didn't know what it was. They said, well, show us how you use it. So I opened the top and started to type. And as the keys started to click, one of these men grabbed my wrists and said to the soldier standing behind him, we mustn't let him do this. He's sending a message to America. So they took away this formidable instrument and tied it up with thick straw rope and put it out on the grass and put a couple of guards on it to make sure that I didn't send any more messages to America. And then they finished their inspection, took my correspondence, put it on top of the typewriter, said they had need to take this away for examination, and then they took us all outside And they took this boy and gave him his reward. Now, this boy had told me before the communists arrived that everybody who had helped the communists was to get a reward. Now, his reward was to come to him. You see, this boy had done a good job. You may wonder, how could they have that list of our property? How did they get to know all the personal articles that belonged to us, even the stuff that was in our bedroom drawers? Well, it was very simple. For I often used to go out into the country on evangelistic and Bible teaching tours, and as I went, I always left the keys of our property with our caretaker at the school, and when I was away, I knew that they had personally conducted tours through our property. And the man who conducted them was our own caretaker. At that time, mark you, I never dreamed that he was a communist. It was only afterwards I was to discover that he was a well-planted communist on my own campus. But I didn't know. And so he led these around, and this little boy had not been asked to do anything wrong, but simply when I was away in the country, he was told to join the crowds who went through our home and to keep my eyes open, to remember everything. He didn't have to even write it down. He just had to develop a good memory and gradually come back and tell the leader of his cell group, who was his teacher in the school, to come back and tell him what he'd seen. And gradually they collated a complete list of everything that we possessed. Some of you people wonder what communist cells are doing on this side of the world today. They're doing that very thing. The former mayor of the city of Toronto, just before he resigned from his position, was to discover through the disclosures of the case of Iga Gakko, you remember the communist spy trial of 1947, in that spy trial it was discovered that, amongst others, the mayor of the city of Toronto had had his life watched by the communist cell groups, and they had collated a complete listing not only of his possessions, also of his public work and also his private life, all his idiosyncrasies and everything else. Everything he did was all listed and photographed onto microfilm and sent along to Ottawa, and Fred Rose, who was a communist in disguise in the House of Commons in Ottawa, then used public monies. We provided him with the public servants. He just pressed a button on his desk, and up they sent the boy up to take his message, and there he had a nice sealed case, which was sent, of course, under special guard to Moscow, not even the RCMP being allowed to open one of those briefcases, specially provided by the Canadian government, and those records sent across to Moscow to be prepared against the day when they believe they'll take over Canada, just as they believe they'll take over the United States, when all that will come into use. And it is the detailed work of the communists in this way that lots of people can't understand. I was speaking down here near Seattle just 2 weeks ago, and when I'd finished speaking, a man got up who was on the Marshall Mission in China, and he just was bursting. He said, it all comes to life to me now. I couldn't understand why it was when I was on that mission, the Chinese communist leader, Mao Zedong, sitting across the table in Yan'an, every time we said, now, give us copies of the maps, where the Japanese are in different parts of China. And every time we wanted a map, they would come across and say, well, look, you know, our maps of Baltimore City or our maps of Washington, D.C. are rather antiquated, and we'd like to have a map of Washington. Well, he said, what on earth is the use of a map of Washington to you? Oh, well, you know, that's our Chinese way. We like to barter things. So you just get me a copy of the map of Washington, and I'll easily get you the map of where the Japanese are in the provinces out on the coast near Shanghai or something else. And they bought it. And he said, I could never understand why it was. Why, of course, that's what they were doing, collating every piece of information they can get. It might not be related, it might be related. And eventually the communist builds up his files on individuals and countries and cities and all the details that he builds up. And even to the communist in his own group, he gets a little bit of information and he passes it on to his cell leader, and his cell leader passes it back, and he may never know where it goes to. He may never know how powerful it is in building up a case against some individual or some group of individuals until the day can come when they can be smeared by the communists. And so the whole system works to that end. Of course, I didn't know that then. All I saw was the effect, and I can witness to the effect. For there it was, a complete listing of everything we possessed. This boy had done his job well. Now he was to be given his reward. And his reward was this. They stood him up on one side of the flag mast, in the campus, and they stood me on the other side of the flag mast, and then they said to this boy, "Now you're in charge of this campus, and anything that the foreigner has to say to us, he has to come through you. And anything that we have to say to him, we also come through you." And they made this boy the liaison on our campus and gave him full authority. And he strutted around like a little peacock, proud of the fact that he was now made the liaison officer for the foreigner. And I'm glad he enjoyed his new job. And in fact, the Chinese called him that, the little peacock, behind his back, of course. This little boy enjoyed his reward. So did everybody else. Very soon, within a matter of a few days, every collaborationist and fellow traveler, as we call them over here, they all of them received rewards. And some of the people now revealed in the community as collaborationists with the communists absolutely amazed us all. The man who lived next door to me, owner of the hydro plant, he had been the leader of the communist underground of our city, a personal friend. A man who used to come and sit at my table very often and eat a foreign meal because he'd learned how to eat foreign food, foreign-style food in Shanghai. And came to listen to my radio, spoke English fluently, and was a well-trusted and respected member of the community. The chairman of the Chamber of Commerce, interested in the life of the people. Never did I dream that when I had him in my home, and when I went to feasts to which he invited me, to banquets, when I'd go to speak and to preach the gospel message, never did I dream I was being invited by a communist leader. Who could have told that the carpenter who served me for 13 years was the leader of the youth groups of our city as underground units? I didn't know these men were communists. In fact, I went to the defense of the son of the chairman of the Chamber of Commerce once when he was accused of being a communist. When he came home from university and people were talking about him being a communist, I asked him to come and see me because I taught him English before he went to university. I knew the boy from he was a little lad. And I went to his defense that it was wrong to so accuse him. And he was excused by the local officials on my defense. Only after the communists came in was this boy then made the leader of all the youth groups for the entire province. And it was revealed that he had been a communist and had been spending his summer holidays mimeographing communist doctrine and communist messages up in a little temple away up on the top of the hill back north of the city. And these had been flowing down the hillside, filling our city with communist propaganda. That's how he'd been spending his summer holidays. And I'd been to his defense. Never did I suspect that he was a real communist. And so, as it was said to you this morning by Dr. Judd, most unsuspected people, serving the communist cause, many of them well-trained agents, some of your American students who've been allowed to go across to the Lenin schools of Moscow, Walter Reuther, who himself was 6 months in Moscow, trained for the job that he's doing now. And don't you quote me, you quote Senator Pepper, isn't it? Who in the congressional record, if you write to Washington, they'll send you the congressional record with, I think it's 36 pages of it, telling of the Walter Reuther case. And today he probably is as powerful, if not more powerful, at least in labor, than the President of the United States. A man well trained. Hoffa the same, Paul Hoffa. Exactly the same. And yet, even talking to Americans and talking to Canadians, they think you're just crazy to suggest that he's a communist. What an idea. Oh, he may have a little bit of a leftist thought. You get to professors in the University of British Columbia and various other universities in Canada. Let me speak of Canada rather than the United States in this particular thing. Your own speakers can speak for the United States better. Although I do happen to know that down here, in the Washington University. Of course, there was a very, very big ring uncovered there and is still operative today. Still hasn't stopped despite exposure and everything else. Still going on. Lots of our students that come down from Canada and go down to the Washington State University. And they go back to Canada, well-trained communists. Well-trained. Just in exactly the way that Dr. Fred Schwarz spoke to us about this morning. their professors in psychology conditioning their minds and brainwashing them, a subject which will be the subject of my next talk to you when I describe the actual process from a practical standpoint. But I'm sorry, let me get back to my subject or I never get through with it. It's such an inexhaustible subject. You'll have to forgive me when I'm asked to speak up in Canada very often for purposes of groups who are really interested. I never speak unless they'll give me at least 2.5 to 3 hours. And with a break in between, of course, so as not to get them too tired when we stand up and walk around. But so the communists were in, and so the fellow travelers were rewarded, and all these men, the head of the hydro plant who lived next door to me, he was made the chief commissar of the district. He had jurisdiction over a population of some 18 million people as the chief commissar. What did he know about such a job? That didn't matter. He had those who could advise him. And then my carpenter, whom I never dreamed was a communist, who had left his communist things behind, proud as could be. He even made the pulpit from which I preach. And he called me after the communists came in, and come and see, Mr. Millen, how loyal I've been to the communists. And what do you think I discovered? That here on the back of the pulpit were 4 communist stars carved on the pulpit. And I'd never even seen them. If I'd seen them, I'd never even dreamed about that. A star isn't foreign in Christian work. Why, of course, the Star of Bethlehem. That's the way I'd have interpreted it, but no. Here were the marks, and on my desk, which he had made for me in my home, he had made a secret device underneath whereby with my foot I could lock the drawers of my desk. It had been a very clever idea, his idea. I didn't really need it very much, but still it was an idea, and I praised him for it at the time, that he did it for me. Now he said, Mr. Millen, come and see. And he got a flashlight. And on the little wooden round piece at the end of that release or lock for the drawers was a lifelike carving of Mao Zedong. As lifelike as could be, carved right on there. And all the time he'd been working for me, he'd been working for Mao Zedong and for the liberation of China. No other thought in his mind. Now he was rewarded. What do you think they did with him? They made him the mayor of the city. And when I saw his name in the newspaper about 4 days after they'd arrived, I couldn't believe myself. I couldn't believe that it really was this man. But the next following day, there was a picture of him, so I had to believe it. So I called one of our Christian leaders, and I said to him, is this really our carpenter? He said, yes, sir, it is. Well, I said, I've always paid my respects to every other mayor who's been elected in this city. Now that this man's been appointed by the new authorities, well, I'm going to go down and pay my respects to him. Are you game to come with me? He said he was. So we got our little boyfriend, who was the liaison and through whom I always had to go, and I knew that by this time. Why, this little boy said, sure, let's go down and see him. So off we went, and he introduced us, and he was our password to go right through the mayor's office and right up to the room of the mayor. When we came in, there he was, with his filthy, dirty, still unwashed, and straw-sandaled feet, stuck up on the desk of the former mayor of the city, a beautiful polished mahogany desk, lolling back in his chair, sucking away at the flexible tube of a water pipe, with the base on the floor and the flexible tube going up to his mouth, enjoying himself immensely. You see, when he was my carpenter, he used to stand up when I went into the room. But now he was the mayor of the city, and the communist mayor at that. Now it was my turn to stand up, and his turn to sit down. And he enjoyed it greatly. What can I do for you, Mr. Millen? I then used all the flowery phrases that I'd learned through all the years to use when I visited officials and wished him 10,000 years of happiness and hoped that all his children and his children's children and their children and their children would all become great officials and so on and so on. And as I was going through this rigmarole, he just cut me short and said, Mr. Millen, enough of that. Have you any business? And when I got over the shock of it, because that was a terrible loss of face, not to me. The loss of face was to the official. For any official who was being addressed in the appropriate manner to break into such statements, why, of course, that was a terrible loss of face to him. That didn't bother him. And I said, well, I haven't any business now, but I said, there will be days when I'll need your help, no doubt. Any time you need my help, Mr. Millen, please come back, good day, and I was dismissed. And when you think in the old days, in the Chinese mayor's office, I used to have to go through three secretariats to get up to see the mayor. And then usually it ended with an invitation to come to my house, and we'd both of us go back to one another's houses before, after two or three days, then we'd deal with our business. The communists brushed aside all that, and I attribute the success of the communists in the establishing of their regime in China to the fact that they brushed aside all the red tape, and as soon as you went to them, you got a decision on anything that you asked for. And now I want to tell you something. From then on, I found these communists quite different from anything about which I had read. Contrary to all the stories of the way that they acted, I found these men were willing to help. There was hardly anything that I asked them that they refused. Did we want meetings? Why, of course we could have meetings. We had greater meetings and more effective meetings than we'd ever had before. Did I wish to go into the country? They would not only arrange for that and arrange for my transport, they would arrange for the people to come and listen to what I had to say. And whereas we used to preach to great milling mobs of uncontrolled people in the temples or wherever we could get a hearing and use our address system to speak to the people, now, when we came under communism, everybody was sitting out in orderly fashion. They listened to everything we had to say. They were allowed to come forward and make their decisions. And there was no problem at all in any of our work. Not only so, the conditions in the community improved almost overnight. I want to tell you, they put on a hygiene campaign to clean up the city, and it surely needed it. And they did a wonderful job. They brought down the prices of the commodities. They raised the living of the workers, their salaries, their wages went up, and the result was that the people all began to speak for communism. It was an amazing thing. There weren't any arrests, with the exception of perhaps one or two, and those were outstanding characters whom we all knew to be the type that the communists would logically go after. But by and large, there was nothing upon which you could put your finger, and at first it was startling. And then you began to realize, well, after all, this is what these men promised they would do. They went out and arrested all the prostitutes, for China was a land of a million brothels, according to Pearl Buck, and they tore down all the red lamps, and they put these poor women not into prisons to make worse criminals out of them, but into rehabilitation centers, where they learned the truth about themselves and their past, and how they had been bought by evil capitalists and placed into these houses of ill fame to make money out of them. Now the communists had come to set them free. Well, wouldn't you be happy if you were one of these women? And it wasn't only a matter of a couple of weeks before they were coming out onto the streets of the city and going through the countryside and telling what communism had done for them. They arrested all the opium addicts. And whereas we as missionaries were glad when one opium addict found Christ as his Savior, and his life was transformed by the mighty transforming power of God, why, we would write a whole article on it, and the Christian magazines of the Western world would take it up and tell the story across the West of one opium addict cured. Why, the communists had hundreds and thousands of cures. Oh, of course, they used more drastic methods, but they just got these men, and when this urge came upon them for their opium, they tied them down to the beds and into the chairs where they sat until the yin had gone past. And of course they were broken of their opium addicts, of their opium lusts. And they came out to tell, once they were through it, what communism had done for them and what a wonderful thing communism was. Wouldn't you do the same? Gambling was virtually wiped out. What could I do as a preacher but commend such a thing? I stood in my pulpit then, every Sunday, and went over the week's newspaper news of the things that had taken place. When the agrarian reform came, and I watched the farmers file down the main street and stand before the chief of police and receive their title deeds to their property, men who had never owned a thing in all their lives, suddenly given a piece of land, and the property that was on it, the buildings and the farming implements, suddenly became theirs. Wasn't this something to praise? The cooperation of the communists in our work. Why shouldn't I praise him? The communist said, Mr. Millen, what about your orphanage? Why do you have it shut? I said, there wasn't enough money to keep it open. We'll get the money for you. The money was soon found. Our orphanage was reopened. The doors were filled. The rooms were filled once again with poor boys who had no parents. And we wept at the things that we now were able to do. After all, our fears had not been justified. Communism was indeed fulfilling all its promises. And as they cooperated with us, the communists received our just praise. And I still praise them today for the way in which they kept their promises. And as they did so, we also encouraged the people to cooperate with them. When they came around and said, we know that there are lots of people in the community who were agents for the nationalists, but we know they did it to make a living. There was nothing else for them to do. They had to cooperate with the nationalist regime. Tell them to come and give themselves up to us, and we'll promise you that every one of them shall come back to their families unmolested. And they did. As they gave themselves up, others were encouraged to do the same, and virtually right through the countryside, all the nationalist agents gave themselves up. They were examined, questioned, and cross-questioned, then came back to their homes. Likewise, when they came and said, we know that there are lots of people of hidden arms and ammunition under their homes, under their farms, why, tell them to bring them all out. No harm will come to them. And very soon they had them piled up on the streets of the city. I'll never forget the day when I stood with the chief of police in our city, and with the commissar, my friend, and with the mayor of the city, the former carpenter, and they invited me to go and witness what took place. And I went down and stood amongst them and saw the piles of ammunition and arms piled so high on the main street of the city, and congratulated the winning team of soldiers who had built the highest pagoda of rifles. And that night they were fêted with a long feast that went on all through the night and a lot of drinking. And as I saw them pick up these arms and throw them into trucks and drive them down the main street and out through the west gate, they said they were taking them out to the sea and they were going to dump them in the sea. They'd driven the nationalists in the sea. Now they would throw away all the munitions of war. They'd come to establish peace. This was the end of war. I want to tell you that unashamedly I wept. Was it possible that a non-Christian, anti-God organization like communism understood the only way to deal with war? Here it was. At last, it took these men to bring in even a political reign of peace. And I want to tell you that I went along with them, and in my broadcasts I praised them, and I meant every word I said, and I still do. I want to tell you, contrary to all you expected me to say, perhaps, that the communist keeps his promises. Did you take that in? The trouble is, he doesn't tell you for how long he's going to keep them. And for 3 wonderful months, we watched the communist attempt to build a utopia. They were amazing months. 3 months is a long time when you're going through it. And during those 3 months, they gave us all the cooperation that we could ask for, to such an extent that we ourselves began to feel that the communists, after all, were not going to be a government under which we couldn't work. And then it was when they had all the information that they wanted, when they had caused the community to loosen up to the extent of revealing a great deal of their past, they called upon us to write out our past history during that first 3 months. I had to write my history out over 30 times before I got out of China. The first time was during those first months. When there seemed no reason, they asked questions, why shouldn't we answer them? They asked questions about members in the church, why shouldn't we answer them? They came along and asked people in their homes about their neighbors, why shouldn't they answer? These men were cooperating, they went around without revolvers, they didn't molest anybody, why shouldn't they have our cooperation? And in the schools, they went to the young people, and they said, now we want you to write essays on yourself and your past life. Be perfectly frank. Tell us all the bad things as well as the good things. Come clean, went up the cry across the land. Come clean. And they did. And they said, now we want you also to tell us about your brothers and sisters, your fathers and mothers, your relatives, your neighbors. And they wrote essay after essay. Little else was done in the schools. All sorts of other studies were excused, excepting sports and so on, those kind of things. And going out into the fields and looking after the fields and so on. Otherwise, the young people had a heyday in the schools. At the end of 3 months, the curtain fell. And it was then that we learned the real difference between Marxist philosophy and Bolshevik terrorism. And in your minds, I want to draw a clear line of distinction. Marxist philosophy, with all its promise of a utopia in this life, and Bolshevik terrorism, which is that other side of communism that we in the West find ourselves so unable to believe almost and to accept. The word Bolshevism was stamped out of the communist vocabulary and from all official documents. I think it was after the year 1945 or 46. Since then, you won't find them using it. You'll never hear the word used now, and as a result, of course, the brainwashing is so good on this side of the world that you'll find none of our newspapers or magazines ever use the word again. The communists have said, don't use it, because it has a stigma attached to it, so of course we want to be kind to the communists, so why should we use the word? Let me tell you what Bolshevism really is. Because lots of people have said, surely it's a different brand of communism that is being offered to the United States. It's an American brand, adjusting itself to the American communities. That's just exactly what we said in China. We said, anyway, if communism comes here, it won't be the Russian kind of communism. It won't be attended with all the atrocities that it was, because that was a revolution of a different kind. This is introducing communism for China. It will adjust itself to China. And, oh, it's just agrarian reform that they're after. Likewise, they said in Europe, it would just be European communism. In England, they say it'll be just English communism, not Bolshevism. But I want to tell you there's no difference. And once the curtain fell, then we understood. But it was too late then. The day was past when anything could be done about it. It was then that the fellow travelers learned the truth. They were the first to be arrested. The mayor of our city, who had been our former carpenter, was arrested that very day. He found himself not being taken to his office, but taken off to an indoctrination course. It was now that they talked about indoctrination centers. This was when they spoke of the people's courts. Now they spoke of the purge. They spoke of reactionaries. These words hadn't been in the communist vocabulary for the first 3 months. For you must remember that the communists came in with an army. The army took over, elevated the fellow travelers into places of responsibility, all people who were known to the community and whom therefore nobody feared. Then when the soldiers left and moved on, it was then when the change took place. And in place of these men in our leadership in our city, we now found the communists left behind what were called the cadres, the men who had been trained as political leaders. Of these, there was a great army. It is estimated that there were 350,000 trained communist shock troops that faced the Chinese Nationalist Army. The Chinese Nationalist Army was German trained by and large, and had a total at that time of about 1.5 million south of the Yangtze River. It only took 350,000 to drive them out. But behind that army of uniformed men of the communist army, it is estimated that some 4 million trained cadres, trained in the arts of psychological warfare and re-establishment of a community as a communist community, agents who were first trained to disarm the communities and then afterwards to suppress them. These were the men who did the real job in China. Let us never forget this. The Lenin schools are established for the purpose of training the great army of psychologically prepared cadres so that they may establish the community. This is what Russia is doing today. This is why Dr. Judd could say that they have men ready to go into Vietnam. They have men ready to go into India. They're in there now. Every Indian missionary will tell you that every time they come out of the country, they don't know if they're going back. They're getting ready to take over India. And their missionaries are in there. Hundreds of them. Thousands of them. All over the Orient. Down in Africa. A man who is a leader of one of the biggest missionary societies of Africa has just been down there and has just come back. And he wrote a letter to me and said, Leslie, whatever you do, somewhere, find the means for us to establish a center in Johannesburg. If we don't know to do it now, it'll be too late. And he was asking us for $20,000 to set up a center for literature and for training men who could go back into civilian life, could go back amongst the civil groups and in every strata of the South African society to fight communism with the gospel, of course. Yes, when communism has taken over, and when all unsuspectingly the community has been lulled to sleep into letting communism come in, just as America. Now, don't think I'm picking on America. When I say America to you, I mean Great Britain as well, and Canada, and all our Western world at the present time, by infiltration, is being lulled to sleep. Look at the fact of how few of us there are here at these meetings. Isn't that an evidence of the apathy that there is toward this thing? This place should be packed and be not near enough, near big enough, if there was a real understanding of the tremendous thing with which we're faced. And the truth about communism was even remotely understood. But people don't understand. They can't see how it's possible for there to be two such complete sides to communism. But you see, the communist front is what you want. The communist Bolshevik back is what they want. They'll give you what you want to begin with. Everything you can ask for. They'll make promises. They'll promise you the sky. And then when they've taken over, and when they have the authority, it's then when they put on the clamps. Now they started through the community. Then it was that accusations were the order of the day. Accusations backwards and forwards. Young people called upon to accuse their parents. The people's courts were set up outside our front door. They had their execution platform with its back to our boys' school wall. And there they would perpetrate the executions. The first people to be executed in our community were the lawyers. This may comfort any of you who happen to be associated with law. Not only lawyers, but law students, or anybody who had anything to do with the legal world. The reason for that, of course, was because lawyers to the communists represent a trained mind. They excused themselves by saying that these lawyers were parasites on the community. They were what they called bloodsuckers. They sucked the blood of the poor. They worked only for the rich and never for the poor. And I'm sorry to have to tell you that that, by and large, was the condition in China. By and large, lawyers in that country did work only for the rich. And so there seemed to be some measure of credence for the thing that the communists did in the first case. But very soon it was evident that it wasn't only the lawyers, but one category after another were taken up. And very soon those who had any kind of leadership, those who in the community demanded any kind of loyalties, were soon being dealt with and brought before the people's courts. And many of the children found themselves in the awful position of having to read the essays that they had written in their classrooms as accusations against their own relatives. Can I ever forget the sight of a little girl whom I first knew when she was only 3 years of age? I used to dandle her on my knee. We had no children at that time, and the Chinese children were always welcome in our home. It was one way that we got near to the Chinese people. And my office door was never closed. I still have a little Bible, which this little girl tore. When I was on my knees in prayer, and she would come in and come and kneel beside me. And she had torn my little Bible in Ephesians chapter 2. and I did my best to explain to her what it meant. Never tired of trying to tell this little child the wonderful, wonderful love of the Lord Jesus for her. But she never responded to that message. And when she was about 11, my wife and I noticed a tremendous change in her. We couldn't understand it. She was in our school. We never dreamed that right in our own Christian school there were teachers who were working for the communists. Yet this child came home with what I now understand to be direct communist thoughts. Insubordination, opposition to the parents, refusal to do what father and mother say. And the consequence was that it became the talk of a group, and we did what we could for the parents in it. Seemed not to get very far with them, and a number of students in our school the same way. We called them discipline problems. I used to have these children up and do my best to love them to Christ and also speak to them quite straightly about their condition and how they were disappointing their parents and so on, but I just couldn't get to first base with them. Never did I dream that the vice principal of our Christian school with his wife were actually organizing communist cell groups in their home on our campus. And after school hours, when I thought that this vice principal was looking after the backward students and giving them extra training as a special tutoring to help them over their problems, never did I dream that they were being taught Marxism. Wonder how many of you realize how much your young people are being taught today. You be careful where your children go. Find out the groups they're going to. Never, never take for granted that a young person is absolutely safe. None of them are safe in these days. Every single new organization that comes into existence must at once be suspected until it can be absolutely proven that it's safe for your child or any other child to go. And this little girl had been well indoctrinated. For by the time the communists came in, she was then around 13 and a half, as I remember it. And when they came in, she was also listed in the newspaper as one of the communist students who had collaborated. And she was given the option as to what she would like to do in those first 3 months. Of course, we didn't know then it was going to be 3 months. And she chose preliminary instruction to become a nurse. And she had a wonderful time. But at the end of 3 months, it was all over. She also had written essays while she was in her training about her parents. And now her mother was up on trial. And her mother was taken to the platform, and I was called out. I had to attend every people's court killing from then on until I left the country, with the exception of the period that I was in indoctrination course that I'll be telling you about, is it tomorrow or the next day. And this little girl was called up on the platform. And she stood in front of the microphone. And as she stood there before the microphone, she was called upon to read the accusation against her mother, the essay that she had read. Well, I'm all right to 3 o'clock, brother, am I? Is that right?
Quarter to three.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I thought you said 3 o'clock. She's not. Then I'll have to stop. And this little girl stood before the microphones and read the accusation against her mother. And she couldn't get through it, and she broke down. And the communists, as she turned and said to them, we heard her over the microphone, why should I have to do this? Am I not going to become a communist? This is my mother. Why should I have to accuse her? And the communists said, you don't understand. We'll teach you. And they took her away. And about 3 months later, that same girl stood before the microphone. And this time, the communists had done what they wanted to do. They had that little child. And she stood up there before the microphone. There was no life in her voice. There wasn't sign of life in her eyes. She just seemed not to be there. And she read in monotone voice the accusation against her mother. And when she'd finished, she called for a show of hands. And as the hands went up, she turned around and took up the knife that was on the table beside her on the platform. And her mother, tied to a post in an emaciated condition, behind her. She tore aside her mother's dress and plunged that knife into her mother's breast. And one after another, the members of the family had to take up that knife and plunge it into that body. I'm speaking to you of 20th century communism. And I'm not speaking to you out of a book. I'm telling you what we saw with our own eyes. Communism has not changed. And if communism comes to the United States of America, it has exactly the same things to offer. Is there any answer to it? Is there any way to stop it? That will be one of the problems that we will face in this school for anti-communists. May God help us that we may find the answer before we leave this place.